Hi, this is Julian Chambliss. It's June 2nd, 2021. I'm on a Zoom call with Tobias C. Van Veen, who is a sound scholar, Afrofuturist sound scholar, turntablist,
tactical turntablist,
installation artist, sound installation artist, commentator, writer, creative in a number of different ways. Tobias, do I have your permission to record you for the Voices of the Black Imaginary Oral History Archive at the Vincent Voice Library at Michigan State University?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much.
Is it all right that your interview will be used for research and made available to the public in that archive?
Yes.
Thank you. So as I was saying, you know, part of my goal with these conversations, which I recognize are not holistic, this is not a compendium, but really it's sort of driven by the interest in a particular aspect, a dimension, one of the many epistemologies of Afrofuturism that are facing us today. And of course, sound is one of the most important. And so I really would like to ask you this question. I like to ask everyone in the context of a very dynamic and important field. How do you define Afrofuturism? And then adding to that, like, how do you sort of understand sound in the context of Afrofuturism?
Yeah, just to be absolutely clear, is the question, how do I define Afrofuturism, or how did I find Afrofuturism?
How do you define
Afrofuturism? Yeah, yeah. Often this gets wrapped up. This is, you know, interesting series of, like, how you define Afrofuturism also depends upon how you come to it.
Right.
And yeah, and then what that means to you. Yeah. I mean, Afrofuturism today, you know, 2021 is very much, I think, one term in a field of terms now attempting to describe Black speculative arts, aesthetics, cultural production, metaphysics, philosophy, practice. Also kind of an emergent Pan-Africanist global politics. And in a way, the discourse has shifted a bit more to using the term Black speculative to encompass a broader sense of radical Black envisioning, imagineering, forms of critique as well, that challenge received histories, particularly white colonial and settler histories that whitewash, particularly the history of colonization in the Americas and across the globe. So Afrofuturism, I mean, we all kind of know the origin story, how it comes about as a term in the early 1990s from Mark Derry's piece. But in a way, that was just kind of a provisional naming, an attempt to begin to sort of map out this amazing phenomena of Black speculative resistance. Which goes back centuries and has deep roots simply in Pan-African cultures across the globe. In some ways, Afrofuturism is the continuing transformation and inheritance of various traditions from across the African continent that have been have had to sort of undergo a kind of covert transformation and sort of almost secret implementation, thanks to colonization and attempts to like eradicate African culture across the Middle Passage. And but really, what gives it its specificity, there's something which really becomes specific about this in the 20th century, is the kind of concurrent rise of science fiction in multiple sites and cultures, which goes along with sort of a literary engagement with technology, the rise of 20th century, late 19th century technologies, to begin envisioning alternate worlds, to begin not just postulating, like a lot of white science fiction did, a kind of future utopia or sort of or engagement with alien others, but from the Black perspective to begin to speak to a history of being alienated, of being treated as alien, and also to not only envision a future for Black folk, a future for Blackness, to envision Blacktopias, Black utopias, Black dystopias, but also Afrofuturism is kind of misnamed because a lot of what it does is revision the past, is try and recover lost histories, recover lost futures, recover avenues that could have been otherwise ideas, experiments, inventions. And this recovery project is at the same time a reinvention project, a very creative reconfiguration of things that may have been lost and retrieved. So Afrofuturism ties in quite a bit to a sense of temporality, a very mutable field of time, that in its own right challenges sort of a Western linear conception of time. It dovetails with Afrocentrism and radical Black politics of the 20th century for sure. There's a focus on recovering and reclaiming Black histories, particularly around ancient Egypt and Kemet, but then also adding this creative science fictional kind of layer to it, which opens it up from the attempt to get at some kind of truth, or instead what's opened up is this sort of multiverse of possible truths of what a Black worlding could look like. That would be something to speak of sort of what Afrofuturism is working at today. And this has just continued forward into the 21st century, where, or, you know, around the mid late 2000s, by the time Rinaldo Anderson puts out his book, Afrofuturism 2.0, we have a kind of second wave of scholars and artists rediscovering the theoretical and literary work of the 1990s that sought to map out the sort of field of Afrofuturist cultural production. And then now the term is being picked up and redefined and reused globally by Black practitioners, artists, writers, musicians, as they see fit, and giving it new definition, challenging it, critiquing it, and coming up with other terms, such as, you know, Black quantum futurism, you know, from Rashida Phillips, or Afrique's futurism with an X from like Valerie Thomas, bring into play ideas of cross gender and the crossroads, and to challenge some of the sort of masculinist and a bit patriarchal narratives that were baked into previous iterations too. So it's still a very beautiful term that wields a lot of potency, only because I think it doesn't actually have one single definition. It very much opens up onto a field of questioning what it is. And that's precisely because what it is always asking the question, what is it we're in? And is this all there is? When there could be something other, radically other and different.
So the flexibility and the expansive nature of the term is really compelling. And I wonder, in the context of sound, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to talk to you, because you are very much associated, I think, with sound and Afrofuturism. Your training as a philosopher and in communication sort of, I think, puts you in a particular place to explore some of the musical aspects of some of your research and writing has specifically talked about the turntable, the DJ, the sort of sonic, sonic imagination, as I often refer to. And talk a little bit about that, because I think many of the things that you mentioned in the sort of definitional element are very much at the core of some of the impact that I personally see around questions of sound, the global nature of it, its long history, the many different permutations associated with sound. This is one of the things that I think is often overlooked, but it's very important, especially in the context, as I often think about this, in the context of the African-American experience, where do we sort of trace this sound idea to? Well, Sun Ra, yes, but, you know, you can stretch that back. And if you think about the precepts of a, you know, a counter-storytelling tool that Afrofuturism is, well, then the orators of the 19th century, you know, all these people are using sound. And so, how does that your work on sound help you to to create a kind of coherence in terms of understanding Afrofuturism as a sound scholar and someone who's in deeply immersed in Afrofuturism?
Yeah, I mean, sound is key. Sound was key. Oh no. Okay. We can edit this a bit. You can always give me the file. I'll slice that out. Sound is key. And I want to approach this from two angles. I mean, one is a bit historically. If you're looking at the if you're looking at the history of African American history, which is to say the erasure of an attempt of African American history by white plantation surveillance capitalism, then sound becomes a way of encoding messaging. It becomes a deeply metaphorical way of actually transmitting messages of resistance and rebellion and very specific directions. And of course, rhythms do as well. And talking drums, the entire heritage of West African drumming rhythms has actually been communicative devices. So this, when we look back at the historical scholarship, we see fascinating like understandings of how rhythm and song were used to communicate slave rebellions and uprisings, as well as used in the Underground Railroad. So songs like "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," for example, have very defined communicative rebellion meanings. Like, okay, next full moon, like someone's coming. This is your chance to like get out, kind of thing. This in a way is this matrix of Afrofuturism and sound is very much in the North American context and or the entire Americas context, anywhere that like the Middle Passage slavery was practiced. Sound becomes this carrier then of future visioning and dreams, and it becomes a way to communicate under the radar. And these quote unquote slave songs, and I should say enslaved Africans, because I don't like determining anyone as a slave. That's just a positionality. That's not an ontology. If we look at "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," that gets picked up, for example, in the 20th century by Parliament, by George Clinton, infamously in concert to hail down the mothership as it lands on stage. They chant for like 15 minutes, like "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," with a deep funk groove, and like down comes the mothership. So Afrofuturism in a way is directly commenting upon, especially in the work of, for example, George Clinton and Parliament, the use of spirituals from the 19th century going back centuries to pick that up and transform it through science fiction as a messaging, a way to get off the planet, to expand the imagination. So when we look at all the genres of what constitutes a kind of Afrofuturist music, I mean, usually this is attached to hip hop and electronic music, mid late 20th century, when you have the repurposing of the turntable, when you have the invention of dub sound system cultures in Jamaica, the narrative of how this is brought over to New York, for example, is relatively well established, usually around Kool Herc, but there were a number of figures. So sound system culture gets transported through the diaspora in a way, a kind of call and response of records and sounds. This is where the work of Paul Gilroy comes in, sort of like the Black Atlantic, although I think the Atlantic's too constrained, right? We now look at the Black Pacific, the Black Global South, like a far more global understanding of this network of sounds. Because what happens here, of course, is the birth of recording technologies. So with radio, you start to hear Black folk appear on air, except they're not appearing, they're non-visual. So Black music starts to insidiously infiltrate radio listeners and white populations. And so I'm kind of picking up on this from various angles. So this is something that Eldridge Cleaver writes about in Soul on Ice, is how Black rock and roll and like Chubby Checker, like the twist, like when Chubby Checker first appears on television doing the twist, how that visual moment so radically transforms aspects of white North American culture, because up to that point, a lot of Black rock and roll and R&B and so forth hadn't yet hit television. So white bodies in a way were being twisted and like reconfigured and introduced to like, what are fundamentally West African rhythms in kind of a secretive operational way, much like these spirituals operated for centuries as kind of encoded messaging. So no matter what the genre we're looking at here, you know, right from the start with Dixieland and jazz and swing and the Lindy Hop, all the way up into rock and roll and R&B and funk and disco and house music, Detroit techno music, electro music, on into the 90s electronic music genres, drum and bass, jungle, up right into the 21st century with trap and dubstep. And of course, I'm reggae, reggaeton, dub, okay, everything happening throughout the Caribbean here. All these sounds, I mean, not only is this like a massive communicative resampling network that's constituting a kind of Pan-Africanist sonic community, that's Paul Gilroy's argument, it's also changing how the world's bodies that hear this sound move in the world. This is kind of a sonic materialist argument. So Afrofuturist sound isn't just about what we normally think of as songs. It's actually like an affective force that gathers people together in different assemblages and makes you move it to different rhythms. This is why you have the disco culture, and it's disco culture, a lot of gender fluidity, space of expression for queer cultures. Whenever you have these kind of dancing cultures begin to foment around the fringes of the social norms of heteronormativity and whiteness, you start to get crazy mixings and blendings, and people become challenged not through argument or ideas, but just through being in a room and moving with other kinds of bodies. You know, sound queers you in a lot of ways. It breaks down barriers. Sound permeates through the flesh and turns you into a kind of moving rhythm machine. So, I mean, several of these ideas were really picked up by Kaju Oshun in the 1990s, who really did a lot of great work thinking about, especially Afrofuturist electronic music, and how it not only did all the things I'm talking about, but how it also alienated the body and brought to the fore a kind of technological flesh continuum that's very late 20th century, and started to think blackness as something that can be transmitted and actually like broadcasted. And you find this in the manifesto, for example, of Underground Resistance from Detroit, who in their short manifesto actually say, like, you know, sound can shatter glass, transmit these tones and wreak havoc with these frequencies, you know, transmit your tones, create your own sonic universe. So, I mean, sound is just potent and powerful. It assembles people, and I'm just thinking about sound. You know, the actual practice of sampling, turntablism, hip hop emceeing, this is also a reconstitution of Black history on the spot. It's very much, like sampling is like signifying upon a tradition, like when hip hop producers and techno producers and house producers, et cetera, sample disco, funk, rock and roll records, they're doing so in a way because they respect that tradition. They are sampling what they love. And it's a way of like recreating, like actually building history and signifying upon one's ancestors within the sonic tradition. And then speaking to that, speaking over it. So hip hop in itself is a repurposing of the Black sonic archives, and in its own way is a reclamation of those Black sonic archives, often from white property ownership and control at the business end of the music industry, which is why you have such battles over IP and why that really matters.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you cover a lot of ground there, and I want to go back because I think one of the things that I've mentioned to students in the past, this idea of sound as a technology. And I think a lot of Afrofuturists will refer to sound as a Black technology. And in particular, certain kinds of sounds are Black technology. The blues is a Black, you know, I think the Last Angel of History, or hip hop. And as you alluded to, like electronic music, so on and so forth. And in that metaphor, one of the things that's interesting to me, and like you, I'm thinking of a little bit about More Brilliant Than the Sun, but I'm thinking also just about the sort of recurring narrative about what are the things that music makes you do, music makes you move. And so there's a element here of reprogramming, and you allude to this too, and hacking, not just simply in terms of you know, how you move, but also the spaces that you move in. And so I'm curious, you know, how do you think about these sort of cultural spaces that are encoded as Black, where Black sounds operate, and also and how those spaces become sort of liberatory, liberation engines, for lack of a better term. I'm making that up. That's just that term I made up, right? Because like, you know, when you describe it that way, well, you know, it's a really quick sort of cognitive exercise. Go like, oh yeah, they sing a lot in Black churches. There's a lot of civil rights movement in Black churches. You know, you think about some of the clubs and some of the narratives and sort of social weight, the protest that it generated from all kinds of music. We don't necessarily always associate it as deliberately as we could in the sort of like, you know, white erasure of hip hop's roots, but hip hop's roots are very much social protest, right? I mean, these are stories from the street, right? So when you think about this intersection in terms of these physical spaces, does that matter? Is that an important part, or is that a consequence? This is sort of the sort of audio, oral, and the physical. What does that do? Is it just simply a consequence of like any Black sound will create spaces where it'll be heard, or is there something in particular that's magnifying by some of these socially created spaces that are connected to Black sound? I'm thinking here to previous artistic movements that many people want to compare Afrofuturism to, like the Black Arts Movement or the Harlem Renaissance or so on and so forth. And I recognize that pattern can be seen in those movements too. So should we take more attention to that?
Yes. I mean, when we're thinking about Afrofuturism today as a movement, like the Black speculative arts movement, that's a little bit different than using Afrofuturism as a heuristic to then trace back what would be Afrofuturist elements of sound within previous movements. Especially, for example, if we're looking at the Black arts movement, Sun Ra was heavily involved there. He actually opened BARTS, the Black Arts Repertory Theater in Harlem. The orchestra marched through Harlem to open the theater. So, you know, there was from the get-go a deep connection between what we would now call one of the pioneers of Afrofuturist jazz and sound and the entire aesthetic, the Black alien aesthetic. And not just an aesthetic, I mean, that is a word that needs to be understood in its philosophical complexity as an organizing series I'll just call it an organizing series of various kinds of categories, because like for Sun Ra, that meant devising music that did not work within Western musical scales, meters, literally trying to write cosmic music, music for the universe that explored entirely different notions of sound that really challenged even West African and African-American musical convention. So that's really where you get that Afrofuturism, that attempt to break through also the inheritance, to devise new forms of rhythm that challenge the body beyond the usual patternings, 4-4 style patternings that undergird a lot of hip hop and dance music, which comes from West African musical tradition. So you have currents of Afrofuturism that break with that really intentionally, that comment upon that break, that make that break itself a sort of revelatory moment musically. So Sun Ra, we need to talk a little bit about, because he trains under and plays with Fletcher Henderson, who's one of the great big band leaders of the jazz era. And his playbook, literally he inherits the playbook from Fletcher Henderson and learns it, and then rewrites that playbook, literally his version of the jazz playbook. And that is the corpus of the orchestra. And it, you know, it has immense musical value for that. I think Sun Ra will be recognized at the towering level of the world's greatest composers in decades and centuries to come. Because if you understand sonically what he's doing, it's as complex as any white modernist, and it's commenting upon a tradition that arguably has had far more potency and power amongst the general population of this planet, the Black musical tradition, you know, versus the quote unquote classical tradition
right.
from Europe. In terms of spaces, it's interesting. I mean, this is a very multivalent question because, I mean, this unfolds so differently in so many different spaces across the planet, right? So, I mean, we can think about spaces too that are entirely different than dance floors. For example, radio. Like, I think radio remains a very potent, powerful force right up all the way through the 20th century and right now into online forms of streaming and broadcasting. So, I mean, I encountered Afrofuturism in a way sonically through late night radio. It was through DJs playing Detroit techno late night on college radio in Vancouver, which is a narrative that actually goes back decades of white kids hearing Black music on the radio and just hearing the sound. This is a complicated narrative because you have plenty of white folk who like the sound, but then can't deal with the Black culture and Black people, and the love stops there. So it's not necessarily like the sound is all the labor and sort of transforms you if you come up in a cultural upbringing of white supremacy, but it can lead you there. It can have a very potent force. It definitely led me there. Well, you know, when I heard hip hop and Detroit techno, that brought me to rave culture. And rave culture was a particular kind of space that was not in a club environment. So it wasn't pressured by the same kind of commercial expectations, age expectations, sort of framework of alcoholism that frameworks club culture, to be frank. Nor was it part of the, I mean, I'm older, so, older. As in I was born later, like, you know, I'm obviously not coming out of like disco. I never went to Studio 54, et cetera. You know, I was born during the disco era. So that environment is something I wasn't around to experience. So for me, it really was warehouse raves and raves in the forest. And in the context, I have to speak of the context where I encountered this, because in a way, this sort of autoethnography matters at this point, because what I started seeing was the promoters of the raves were bringing in the Black Chicago house DJs and producers, the Black Detroit techno producers. And I was like, oh shit, this music's Black. Because at that point, there was no internet. There was no way to find it out. And, you know, I'm like 15. And so the only way was to go to the record store, start buying the records. So I started buying the records and I saved up for my first turntables. And on the records would be a fax number. So I faxed Underground Resistance and said, you know, can you send me your catalog? Because that's what you did back then. No website, right? So, you know, Mad Mike faxed back, right? And so that, you know, the opportunity to reach out and establish an interesting dialogue at that point to, you know, and I started buying the records and getting involved. And then with each record become a press release. And the press releases from like Jeff Mills, Underground Resistance, it was crazy. It was like full like Interstellar manifestos. And I got like the Drexia press release, and it's full of their like mythology, which is now very well known and celebrated and comic booked and talked a lot about. When that stuff was coming out, it was like wild underground. No one knew really what this meant. This was not a press release. You were getting some kind of fragment of like an ever-evolving like science fictional universe, and we had no name for it. And then with early internet, you know, this is where we started to see people like try and get together to talk about this, right? Early publications from Kajua Shun, early essays by Mark Sinker and Mark Derry and Greg Tate, right? So the birth of the Afrofuturism.net listserv and mailing lists with like Alondra Nelson and DJ Spooky, Paul Miller. I saw Paul Miller speak in 97 at UBC and ended up having a long conversation with him. And that sparked a sort of creative friendship that's been going on for decades now. So like the spaces that the music creates isn't necessarily just the physical space where you get together and dance. That space is in the mind. That space has to do with a networking of spaces too, that reaches out globally into like the strangest of places. I mean, I'm from Vancouver, Canada. I mean, you know, most Americans wouldn't know where that is on a map, you know, like maybe I'm making assumptions, but like, you know, I'm just some white guy from a corner of Canada, and like, cause you know, end up bringing fully into this world. So, yeah, I mean, I still think the dance floor space is really, really important, But you know, it's 2021. It's interesting to comment upon this right now when clubs are still closed, when the whole dance music industry has suffered greatly, as well as many industries during the pandemic, and to see how this is translated into online spaces with Twitch, which I've become heavily involved in. And you know, so I follow all the same DJs on Twitch. And what's fascinating actually is we're now being brought into their space. We're being brought into their studio spaces. Like, I love it now. Like, you know, I'll tune into like a Twitch channel of like, you know, New York or Chicago house DJs, and it's in their production studio and they're all hanging out, and I'm getting to see them play records and music or play live in their studio. So instead of being on the dance floor space where they're being brought in, we're now being brought into their space. And that's actually created a fascinating kind of new digital intimacy and understanding of who these producers are and where they're coming from. That never existed before. So this notion of the sort of black space Afrofuturism just keeps transforming through different modalities. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really interesting to think about you as a scholar, because I am curious as to, you know, that biography of, you know, I was exposed to the music, but how do you become a scholar of Afrofuturism, right? Like, you have doctorates in philosophy and communication. I'm willing to bet that this wasn't something that was like core in the program when you start saying, I'm thinking about writing about. I mean, as I'm an odd scholar too, so I can imagine that this is even more complicated. So, you know, and that complication, of course, means everything in terms of the institutionalization of knowledge. And that's why it's a worthy question to ask, because as we are in this moment and we are talking about at some level, and I sometimes, you know, comment to colleagues, and that we are in this moment where institutions are starting to archive, they're starting to formulate the official story of. Yes, there's a story that were out there, but now there's an official story of being created. And who, what, when, where, how, it's falling to an eclectic group of different kinds of professionals to say, yeah, this is what Afrofuturism is. And this is what it was. And, you know, the implications of like what it will be become very, 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 very important very, very quickly. So talk a little bit about like the sort of scholarly construction of a sonic imaginary that is represented and you're in conversation with through you know, guest editing and different sort of journals, like you did a special issue of, I think it's called Dance Cult, or and Topia, which is a Canadian journal, and you're in a kind of right, and you're in the middle of a very important set of conversations, both as a practitioner, because I have tuned into your Twitch stream and seen your show, and as a scholar who is actually writing about creating the kind of corpus of information that becomes an institutional record. And so how do you get there, and what do you see as the implications of this moment for that, this movement, for this form, for this legacy?
Yeah. This is a really interesting and very serious question in some ways. And let me start with just a little bit of autoethnography, just a little, because there was no very, very little emphasis upon critical race studies or Black studies when I came up as an undergraduate in English honors. Now, we did get post-colonialism and post-colonial studies, but that was mainly focused through a British Indian subcontinent lens. But at one point, I decided to give a presentation in one of my English seminars on Detroit techno. I don't remember exactly the context. I still have the presentation and the mixtape that I made. And I talked about Jeff Mills records and Underground Resistance and Drexia. And I was a DJ at that point. So I wasn't approaching it from, I'm a scholar, what I want to study. It was, this is something that I'm actually involved in. I'm out playing raves every weekend. I'm in touch with this. and I wanted to bring it into the academic context, you know, and I was like 20. And my professor at the time, bless him, Dr. Kieran Kearley, he said, he looked at me after the presentation, he said, you need to write about this. And he was right. And I didn't really pay too much attention to him. I, because I'm 20 and I don't know what to do with, you know, really to do with this. I'm an undergraduate. But as I looked to going into grad school, McGill Communication Studies, I'd started talking a lot about rave culture at the time, rave culture and the politics of rave culture. I'm very interested in how rave culture generated a kind of anarcho-collectivist politic. Not in any like traditional sense, but in the assemblage of bodies towards collectivist means. I was very interested in Reclaim the Streets and the use of sound systems, the idea of bringing sound systems from night culture into day, the use of, in a way, a kind of sonic resistance or sonic weaponry. And these are things that have been picked up too by Steve Goodman, who in his book, Sonic Warfare, he also comes from very similar background to me. He's a little older, so he really experienced the UK acid house and early like drum and bass and jungle scenes. He was part of the CCRU, the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit at Warwick with Kajua Shun. And that's a big component of the intellectual heritage and sort of radicalization. So when I started tapping into Afrofuturist scholarship, there wasn't any. There was Kajua's work. There was the early social text issue, which came out in 2000. But I mean, in the 90s, there was basically, you know, there were just, so this social text issue. But in the 90s, it was mainly like music industry publications, like, you know, issues of magazines like Accelerator and like Fader that would like talk about UR and like the mythology, and articles by Philip Sherburne and like Simon Reynolds and Greg Tate and Kajwo in The Wire, and the publications of the CCRU, their pamphlets. So it was a very underground hyperculture, very 90s, pre-millennial tension kind of vibe to Afrofuturism, you know, very much tied in with DJ Spooky and Tricky, and like had that angst to it as we all headed towards the millennium and we're on the threshold of this new technology that we didn't realize would just turn into the bat, like the sort of totally banal online shopping experience of social media that is today to a large extent. It was still felt very radical, and the music really reflected that. The electronic music of the 90s has this tension to it, this drive, this already sonically baked in sense of like a lost nostalgia and a lost utopia, as we realized how quickly this was all going to become commercialized and heavily policed. So rave culture and Afrofuturism went hand in hand here. By the time I ended up, I wrote my master's degree on DJ Spooky, on his book Rhythm Science, and on sampling, and also on the idea of the hauntology of Blackness. I was very interested in how Paul D. Miller becomes DJ Spooky and his discussion of thinking of himself as a new griot. So you're talking about the orators and the storytellers and the use of sound, thinking about hip hop MCs and DJs as griots, as like the kind of subcultural storytellers that pass down the wisdom traditions. When I came to do my PhD, I actually presented my supervisor with a choice. Because at that point, I've been studying a lot of anarchist thought and theory, sort of from the European traditions, Deleuze and Guattari, and Italian autonomia. And I said, maybe I want to do a PhD on Italian autonomia, because they use a lot of technology, like radio, and they're into pirate radio and new ways of creating social collectives. And I saw, you know, I really wanted to dive full into that theory and then talk about rave culture. Or I said Afrofuturism, the sort of philosophy of Afrofuturism, the kind of, you know, not just discussing Afrofuturism as a movement and doing that kind of work, but I was really interested in the philosophy of Afrofuturism. How does it challenge Western conceptions of time and history? How does it upend Western notions of identity? So really wanting to think Frantz Fanon and Afrofuturism together. Little did I know I could have done both at the same time. If I would have actually mixed them, I would have ended up with the same theoretical background as Fred Moten in The Undercommons, because that's exactly what he does. He takes elements of Afrofuturist thought under the brand of Afropessimism, but a lot of that is effectively Afrofuturist, which is another discussion of the institutionalization of knowledge and what is given validation and what isn't, and autonomia, and he mixes it together. I should have done that. But when I wrote the dissertation on Afrofuturism, which we're talking 2005 is when I started writing this, there was no literature out there. And I really mean there was no literature. I'm not saying this like I didn't search. I really meant there was very little published on Afrofuturism at the time. There was early work by like Lisa Jacek. There was some work by Mark Bold. There was discussion of Afrofuturism within science fiction and literary studies as a genre. But I found that way too limiting. I even found like Alondra Nelson's definition in the social text issue was very limiting too. It was confusing. It talked about it as both a global thing and yet as somehow an African-American genre. And I just thought all these perspectives were too limiting because I was seeing it from a perspective of sound, of global sound and culture. And I saw this as something far greater, as a whole challenge to the Western project. You know, as a manifestation of a particular kind of resistance, to use that word in a way which is overused, but also as containing within itself the a whole parameter of like philosophical challenges to fundamental Western conceptions. And up until that point, I've been fully trained in philosophy, white philosophy, Western philosophy, Plato, et cetera, et cetera. I'd never been taught anything about where that came from. Never been taught anything about ancient Egypt or Kemet or Imhotep or the Eastern traditions from which Pythagoras and Parmenides and Socrates all got it from, which isn't to critique them. It's to critique the way we teach it today, as if that origin appears out of nothing and there's nothing worth teaching before that point. And I realized that was an institutional racism. And I realized how baked in that was when I started reading the Introduction to the Philosophy of World History by Hegel. And even though I've been taught Hegel for years, no one had bothered to teach us the introduction, which is blatantly racist over a period of about 10 pages. That made me furious. So I was actually really driven, like coming out of this kind of like anarcho-collectivist raver background. I'm a counterculturist first and academic second. And this is why I don't have tenure. Like my priorities have been more around the research and the momentum and the culture than it has been about doing all the things you need to do to advance within the institution. And this really matters in terms of the politics of institutional knowledge, because definitely today what we're seeing is an attempt to uptake Afrofuturism into the academy, into kind of an acceptable discourse that fits back into various kinds of parameters, representation, identity politics. I'm using those with quotation marks around them. And it's also being positioned in such a way where Afropessimism is considered to be the real critical discourse, because anything that's pessimistic and critical and cynical is somehow considered to be more intellectually valid than something which posits alternate imaginaries, alternate realities. There's been a weird growing distrust of the imaginary within the white academy, but also aspects of what constitutes the serious Black academy. And I think there's reasons for that in order to establish various kinds of epistemological legitimacy, like for Black studies. But Afrofuturism, as it enters into the academy, challenges that kind of perspective. It says, no, we can dream otherwise. We can challenge interdictions to think outside the box. And you know, I wrote a small piece discussing Chomsky and Foucault from an Afrofuturist perspective, their infamous late 70s TV debate, where Foucault basically says, no, we can't imagine anything, you know, outside of where we are. And more than that, it's kind of dangerous to do so. And I just said, who does Foucault mean by the we? You know, him, white culture, white Europeans? Yeah, maybe white European culture shouldn't be imagining any more futures, because the utopian futures they keep imagining and dovetail into fascism or like horrific forms of communism or like ever, you know, and never ending exploitive capitalism. So maybe that is correct, but maybe there are literally epistemological caesaras that need to be considered here, where we have entirely alternate other traditions coming out of. And this is where it's not just Afrofuturism, it's not just Black cultures, it's the whole, you know, ontology and epistemology of oppressed and indigenous cultures worldwide that are perhaps more fully capable of imagining alternatives than have, you know. It's just that the white European theoretical project hasn't considered this because of its institutional white racism. And I mean, this is what drives me with the Afrofuturist project. It's not, yes, I'm obviously deeply, I love Black cultures, I love Black music. It's a part of who I am and what I do. But what drives me within the institution is I'm challenging, trying to challenge the way that philosophy is taught. I'm trying to challenge the way that even communication studies is taught. I'm trying to bring in Black narratives from the get-go, and not just in the sense of representation, like, oh, for every white person who did this, there's a Black person. They just haven't been recognized. That's one level. Yes, that's fantastic. But actually challenge the founding concepts by which we do academic labor. Like Afrofuturism is, you know, challenges Afropessimism. You know, Afropessimism sort of ends at a certain point. It diagnoses everything wrong with necropolitics. And, you know, you kind of have to say, yeah. But that Caesarea is where Afrofuturism begins, you know, because it provides the exits, the alternative strategies.
Right.
And I think that takes an imaginary and a background that, like, scholars and institutionalized scholars who see Afrofuturism as just something neat to write about, they don't get that. They're not bringing that argument or heft or weight to the project. They're just seeing it as a topic or a genre to write about. But they're not seeing it as a challenge to the way that we do academia itself.
Right. So
yeah, that makes sense. This, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, that does make sense, because I think one of the things that is a question for me is this idea that, you know, I'm referring, like, the museological turn that's necessary for transformation to happen, that does require imagination, right? It requires, like, you to at some level go up to the edge and then step off.
Yeah.
Right? Like metaphorically and literally, you need to go to a place where there are no longer these guideposts that you understand, because the guideposts are wrong. And this is the thing about Afrofuturism, I think, is the most troubling, but also the most entangling, right? As you say, our estimation of what we should do from a kind of critical perspective, Scott, I mean, there's an element that there's a space that has been created in our institutional framework around criticizing, but not necessarily transforming. Right, like, and that's a simplification, but it seems inherent to Afrofuturism, though, is transformation. Like, the point of the project is transformation. Yep. So any sort of investigation, any kind of conversation, any kind of, like, movement that is connected to it, invariably is like, well, there's got to be a transformation, right? And I do think that makes, there's got to be a transformation, and then the other part of it that is maybe sometimes difficult for people to see is, like, this is how you do it. These are the tenets of why. This is the framework of, like, this is the new source code for society, right? Like, it's this, yeah, not that. It's this, not this, right? Like, it's that, not this, right? It's sort of always in there, but it's caught up in lots of other kind of, you know, it's an odd connective tissue. And as you say, you know, as an academic, and as a practitioner, you know, you mentioned, like, I'm not moving ahead in the academy. I find interesting, because I think, you know, previous to this moment, even before the pandemic, there were plenty of people talking about the nature of a broken academy. And it's not really that shocking to me that the nature of that broken academy, or the things about it being broken, have corresponded, the increasing sense of brokenness has corresponded to the increasing number of people who are not white going around, this isn't right, this isn't right, this isn't right, this isn't right. Like, not white, not male, not straight, going like, well, I don't, you know, and the system's breaking down. You're like, it was broken before. You can make an argument it was broken before, this person is pointing out it was broken, right? Like, you know, can you fix it? So, you know, ultimately the question, this becomes a question for Afrofuturism. Can it fix it? Right? Can Afrofuturism be the vehicle for transformation that I think a lot of us associate it with? And if so, what does it look like for people on the ground to experience that transformative redemption transformation.
I mean, I think it already is, right? I mean, we like wouldn't be talking about it, obviously, if it wasn't. It's because it has such force, and this goes back centuries, that you know, we're talking about it. We're like inscribing it in the realm of the academy. So now we're thinking about it, though, with as the institutional academy discourse. You know, can't. This sort of multiple levels to this. I mean, I spent 5 years working with Zig Zagar's The Bastard out of Los Angeles, a Black performance poet, making film and photography and manifestos. And I can not speak for her, but simply echo what she's told me, and which is in her writing, which is that Afrofuturism as a force for her is lived. It's lived practice and experience, and absolutely transformative. And there are narratives from various artists and Afrofuturist practitioners who, you know, say like Afrofuturism, not the word, the term, the movement, the branding, but what this means as practice in my life has, in a word, given me the energy, a whole new outlook on life, the ability to retransform myself. It has that connection to that kind of 60s, 70s Black arts movement style, like transformation of name, renaming of self, giving up the white slaveholder last name, but without the current of Afrocentrism, of trying to reclaim a lost African heritage in sort of an authentic mode, but reinventing a new mode of being. This is something which particularly speaks to Black experience. Obviously, I am not Black. The way that it's transformed me has been different. It's transformed me in the sense of honestly making me far more receptive and sensitive to obviously issues of race, and wanting to talk about race in the classroom, in the institution, and in the academy as a white person, and seeing my role as a white abolitionist, to use that term, to specifically use whatever white privilege I have to talk about race, to get other white kids to listen. I'm not teaching Black kids much, if anything. They teach me in the classroom straight up. But I'm trying to teach the white kids, in a way, how to engage with Afrofuturism, which in a way which isn't novelty, isn't like some kind of exoticism of the other. You know, why are Black people like dressing up like aliens, right? Because that's the level that this is coming across, trying to get at the deeper understanding of what is happening here and what is being communicated, something which is almost an inherent level of knowledge when you come out of Black culture, right? So it's also doing the work of cultural translation. So when we think about Afrofuturism in the academy, we're also in a way translating it for a very white academy, and an institutionalized Black academy in other circles, which didn't clue into Afrofuturism, because Afrofuturism as an academy discourse is very new, only in the past couple of years. Like, and now we're seeing swaths of courses appear on Afrofuturism being taught in various contexts, right? Mainly by sessionals. This is a point that Rinaldo Anderson brings up too. Like, when you look at all the contributors to the volumes that have been put out, like Afrofuturism 2.0 and Black Speculative Arts Movement, you know, a lot of these scholars at the point of publication were PhD students, postdocs, sessionals. I mean, this is not a discourse that has come from the established figures. You know, this is a discourse that has come out of those on the margins. I mean, we look at how broke the academy is. I mean, we're talking about the new liberalization of everything, the precarity of everything now, but we're also looking at a very, I think, coordinated white supremacist attack on the academy in general, in both the sciences and arts, right? This is a general attempt to kill the academy, because any knowledge, you know, makes people question things. And we're also seeing a coordinated attack right now, 2021, on the teaching of critical race theory in both Canada and the United States, to the point where this discourse is literally being legislated and banned, right? So Afrofuturism has some interesting work here to do, and it maybe could do some interesting work in the sense that, okay, you've banned a critical race theory, but we can talk about Afrofuturism. Like, I was just thinking about this recently. But we're in a point now, I mean, here in Canada, for example, an entire university, like at least eight departments were closed, like shut down, Laurentian University, mainly in the arts, but also sciences, by the administration. We're seeing this many places. So I think it's a lot of pressure to just put on Afrofuturism as the kind of discourse that might counter what's happening within the academy at that level. But at the same time, whenever I see Afrofuturism being taught, the classes are full. You know, there's a line out the door. Like, the students want this. And when we're talking about the students, we're talking about the children now of Gen Xers. I'm a Gen Xer. You know, we're the slacker, but like, we're like the lost generation, the generation that's like never got any cred from the boomers. We just like slipped under the radar. And like, that's why we invented rave culture as a generation. You can argue that, you know, and took on the mantle of punk. And, you know, so to today's generation, like the children of the Gen Xers, whatever you want to call them, Gen Z, Gen Z, I don't know, but they want solutions. They don't need critique. They know what's wrong. They know we're on a dying planet. They know we're in the Anthropocene. We don't need to make arguments that these things are happening anymore for them. The only reason we're still trying to argue that these things are still happening is because we're trying to convince the older generations they're happening. And in a way, that's a lost cause. What we really need to counter is the ongoing like propagation or like propaganda that climate change isn't happening, Anthropocene isn't happening, that global fascism is not on the rise, that white supremacy isn't terrorism. We need to counter all of that because that gets propagated down to the younger generations. They, you know, especially in the United States, which is incredibly polarized. And again, we're in 2021, we're in a situation right now where 70% approximately of Republicans believe the election was stolen. You know, so this is very dangerous territory. In the class that I just taught this past semester, we looked at the relationship between radio and the rise of the Nazi Party in 1930s Germany. So there's good critical communication studies scholarship on what happens when a large section of the population believes in propaganda, a lie. So, I mean, Afrofuturism is of this historical moment. It is, in a way, I hate using the term weapon, but I'm thinking of Fela. You know, music is a weapon. Not a weapon to do violence, but a weapon to do love. And sometimes love hurts when you're on the receiving end of it. Okay, so that's how it's weaponized, right? Right? Like, I think it's a lot of pressure on Afrofuturism to like address all of this, but it is part of the mix. And it's a very potent aspect of that mix, which includes indigenous futurisms right now too. I think it's really important to correlate this to a general anti-colonial project of decolonization, which isn't just a word, and it's not just about changing names. You know, tearing down statues is just the start. If you know, I'm talking about a politics of like, you know, land back, reparations, like very material, you know, socioeconomic changes to the way that the colonial nation states are run, and especially property, you know, giving property back to those who have been oppressed and from whom that was stolen, including all the resource and extraction rights. That argument in itself is an indigenous futurism. That is an Afrofuturism, that hardcore socioeconomic aspect of it. And often that's not, we talk about the institutionalization of this knowledge, that's often not being taught. What's being taught is like, oh, look at Janelle Monae and look at Sun Ra. Oh, aren't they like alien? Not understanding the politic of alienation, of Black alienation, of feeling ontologically separated from the white enlightenment ideal of the human, of inheriting generations of trauma, of what that does. So, you know, when I think about the scope of Afrofuturism, it's in the scope of Black Lives Matter. It's in the scope of generally leftist arguments to reconfigure the nation state, the settler colony. And that's why the Topia issue that Ronaldo and I put out, that's why we call it Black Lives, Black Politics, Black Futures. You know? Yeah.
Well, I think it's, any conversation about Afrofuturism can go on and on, but I have to stop. In part because I think you've given everyone a lot of information to cover. One last thing I would ask you is if you were going to give people a quick and dirty reading list. Read this, read this, read this, read this. Four or five things to read. What would it be to have them understand this question of sound and Afrofuturism a little bit better?
More Brilliant Than the Sun by Kajua Shun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're into electronic music, this is beautifully written. It'll blow your mind. It's like a series of Zen koans at points. He really gets the music into the writing. He makes it shape the language and he invents new concepts. It's full of concepts. And a lot of the theoretical work I do has been mining Ashun and explicating it, treating him like any other major philosopher. I consider this a major philosophical intervention. The two volumes that Rinaldo Anderson has been behind for sure, Afrofuturism 2.0 lays the groundwork for contemporary scholarship today. And so does the follow-up, the Black Speculative Arts Movement, which pushes out the conversation into the idea of a movement. And of course, BSAM, Black Speculative Arts Movement, is a movement. It hosts events and conferences and so forth. So I would simply recommend subscribing to that, tuning into that, going to events, virtual things, subscribing to their mailing lists and like pages and so forth, getting, you know, because this conversation isn't just happening in publications, it's like happening live, you know, like out there. For my part, I would suggest the Topia issue. You know, obviously this is something I've been involved in, but more than that, the introduction here, Future Movements, Black Lives, Black Politics, Black Futures, this is, as far as I can tell, the first time that anyone lays out the parameters for an Afrofuturist studies. So the idea that Afrofuturism within the academy, the politics of like institutionalization of knowledge, we need an Afrofuturist studies. This is advanced here. Also amazing essays here by Valerie Thomas and like Robin Maynard and many other contributors that are just fantastic and on point. And then what's happening right now is I'm working with Dr. Lonnie J. Avi Brooks, who does a lot of work on gaming and Afrofutures. And we have started up a new book series at Lexington called Afrofuturist Studies and the Speculative Arts. So we're creating a publication channel. And in a way, we're very much like a sister publication channel to the New Suns publication channel at Ohio State. So it's, in terms of institutional aspect, it's like not only what to read on the reading list, but what to follow, like follow these two presses, check what's coming out, because the agenda here is to put out future publications that are kind of working at this level, you know, that aren't trying to just tokenize Afrofuturism, but are engaging with it at the deepest possible levels. And I think it's like a general introduction. Mm-hmm. I gotta hand it to like Tasha Womack. Her book Afrofuturism is like very accessible, very well written, contains open-ended definitions and has interviews with a lot of fascinating people. And every time I teach Afrofuturism, you know, this is the reader, you know, I mean, this is like the entry point before you get into the more complicated scholarship. This does a lot of good work. There are so many publications otherwise that like run the gamut that can bring you into various aspects of it, you know, from the work of like Julian Enriquez on sonic bodies or Francesca Royster and like sounding like a no-no. And there's all these like publications and sound studies that discuss queerness and Black sound studies, including Eric Steinskog's work. Mm-hmm. The one other white scholar in Afrofuturism. I feel like there's, I mean, I'm sure there's maybe a couple others, but there's two of us white guys doing, you know, doing this who you know, are very invested in it as a project. And, you know, there's like theoretical aspects here too. Like I think a lot of the work by Alexander Wahalahi, like Habeas Fiscus, because he was involved with the mailing list, with the social text issue. He wrote on Afrofuturism 20 odd years ago. That's continued forward to a philosophical project discussing like Sylvia Winter and thinking about Black ontology. That's really important. And then following up on issues like seeing what's coming out on Obsidian, because they've been putting out wicked stuff. I mean, particularly this issue, obviously this is one of Stacey Robinson's artworks on the cover. I mean, that's a pretty good constellation. Right now, there's a lot of work coming out. There's a lot of book coming out right now on Black ontology around Black studies that touches on aspects of Afrofuturism. But I'm really excited about what's to come. I think in the next 2, 3 years, it's like, I think we've laid the groundwork for an Afrofuturist studies and kind of a discussion. And now I'm interested in the scholars who are going to pick up on that discussion, who are going to be speaking to the publications that have come out in the past 5 to 7 years. Too many publications right now keep referencing dairy, keep like resetting the entire conversation, and are not proceeding as if we do not have a discussion happening right now, which we do. So I actually call upon scholars to do the reading and to do the engagement and to further where we're going with this.
That's a great point. We're old enough now that we can start thinking about refining these ideas. Well, thank you so much. And been very generous with your time, very thoughtful with your answers, and that's really compelling in terms of, I think, broadening our understanding of Afrofuturism.
Thank you so much, Julian. I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this archive. I think it's a fantastic project. I wish I had archives from the 90s,
Right.
right? Of
Yeah.
this, you know, we just don't have it.
We
So
don't have it. Yeah.
it's super key. Like, we're capturing something live and in the moment. Anyone watching or listening, this is very much live theory. This is improvised. I have no notes. I'm speaking off the cuff.
Right.
And
Yeah.
it's important to understand that context. You know, as academics and the kind of discourse that we're establishing here as a rapport, this is totally dialogical. This is call and response. You know, nothing of this is planned. So thank you,
Thank you, man.
Julian, for this.